It is Friday, February the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, an appeals court refuses to reinstate the Trump travel ban.
At the heart of what the court ruled is that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution protects due process, and that this executive order may interfere with the due process rights of some citizens or residents or loved ones from the involved state.
Also ahead, fighting the Islamic State in key cities in Iraq and Syria, plus the Grammys coming up and the latest on music star from the country music, Randy Travis. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A U.S. federal appeals court has refused to reinstate President Trump's ban on travelers from seven predominantly Muslim nations. The three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco unanimously declined to block a lower court ruling that suspended the ban and allowed previously barred travelers to enter the United States. International Edition's Lori London speaks with Anna Rose Matheson. She is a partner at the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco, who actively litigates in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
It's a clear win for the state. The opinion is unanimous, so all three judges, including a Bush appointee, agreed in the result. And the opinion goes through, kind of at the heart of it, finds that the government has not shown it is likely to succeed on the due process claim the states make. And so procedural posture is somewhat odd here because the states moved in the district court to try to get an injunction, that is to try to get the president's order stopped and not enforced. The district court granted a temporary restraining order, said we are going to temporarily stop the program until we can decide whether or not, after a fuller hearing, whether or not to stop this order. So the government had to show that it was likely to win and beat the states on their due process claim. At the heart of the opinion, the court rules that the government has not met its burden of showing it is likely to succeed on the due process issue.
When the judges wrote their opinion, did they give specifics on why they came to the conclusion that they did?
The court walks through a number of the preliminary issues. Both parties ended up having procedural issues that they argued. But at the heart of what the court ruled is that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution protects due process, and that this executive order may interfere with the due process rights of some citizens or residents or loved ones from the involved state. And the court said the state could assert those rights, and because the government hadn't met its burden of showing that it was likely to be able to prove there wasn't a due process violation here, it was going to allow the lower court's order stopping the president's executive order, a Muslim ban, was going to not overturn what the district court had done.
How did it come to the decision? Is it rooted in prior cases, or did it just look at the constitutionality?
Oh, it's deeply rooted in prior cases. The court goes through and rejects several arguments the government made for why the court shouldn't be able to decide and should just defer to the president on issues of national security. And the court walks through a number of prior cases from the Supreme Court and other courts saying time and again, no, it's the obligation of courts to decide issues of constitutionality. We can't simply defer when the president says, I'm making this decision based on national security. Courts can simply say, oh, well, then we're out. Instead, the courts have an obligation to protect the rights of people who come to it. And in ruling on these constitutional issues and in protecting due process, the courts have been doing exactly what they've done for centuries and what the Constitution says they're supposed to do. The opinion goes through carefully those decisions, and it goes through the decisions of both the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts saying that the due process right of all of the involved people, the people affected by this travel ban, are significant, can't be brushed away by the administration. The government tried to make it so the court wouldn't consider those by, for instance, saying the ban wouldn't apply to permanent residents. And the court said, well, look, that's one person, White House counsel, who says that. That's not a formal modification of the executive order. And anyways, given how much the administration has been going back and forth, we don't necessarily have faith that interpretation is going to stand.
Did they talk at all about religious discrimination arguments?
They did. They suggested that the religious discrimination arguments raise serious concerns, but they didn't actually rest the opinion on that. It's possible that this was a compromise because there are three judges on the panel, and all three of them signed onto this opinion. So it's possible that one of the judges, most likely from the argument, Judge Clifton, had concerns about this religious discrimination piece. And so all the opinion says is the states have raised serious questions, but the court doesn't decide it on that basis. It only decides the case on the due process claims.
Is this likely to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court as it would, the president immediately tweeted out, see you in court.
Yes, which was kind of a funny thing for him to say, given that he just lost in court and had previously lost in the trial court. But yes, see you in court. It's almost certainly going to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the U.S. Supreme Court can act quickly. They'll probably already have this flagged as something that is likely coming to them.
That is Anna Rose Matheson, a partner at the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco. She actively litigates in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and she was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Well, as we just heard, President Trump responded to the appeals court decision with a tweet. He wrote, "See you in court. The security of our nation is at stake." Other tweets included from at Chamika C. writing, "I'm more afraid of my neighbor who has a Confederate flag hanging outside than I am of a Muslim." At the Meme Streams wrote, "Thanks for putting American lives in danger, hashtag Ninth Circuit. You should all be disbarred." At the Millionaire 4 wrote, "The POTUS yelling, 'I see you in court,' while already in a court is the type of thing no satirist would be clever enough to come up with." And at Five Rights wrote, "Trump cares too much about us to let renegade Ninth Circuit thwart his immigration order. He'll prevail. It's what he does." You, our listeners, can go to Twitter yourself. Check out all the tweets. There are many of them. Hashtag Ninth Circuit, referring to the court which made the decision Thursday, is a trending hashtag, as is See You in Court and Appeals Court. Still ahead on International Edition, the battle to retake Raqqa in Mosul from the Islamic State. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turkey says a Russian airstrike has accidentally killed three Turkish soldiers in northern Syria. Military statement said the Russian military was carrying out an operation targeting the Islamic State at the time of that incident. It said Russian President Vladimir Putin has called his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, to offer his condolences. The Kremlin said that both sides had agreed to step up their military coordination in Syria. Meantime, speaking while on a tour of north of Baghdad, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, said he remains hopeful that Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria can be taken from the Islamic State within months.
We take away their two capitals, their Iraqi capital of Mosul and their Syrian capital of Raqqa, they're not going to really be able to claim that they have a physical caliphate anymore. That doesn't mean ISIL's gone. They'll still be around. They'll change their nature, but they can't lay claim to having a physical caliphate once we've taken Mosul and Raqqa. Both of those things are in progress right now, and I think you'll see both of those conclude here in the next few months. I want to see Mosul done, and I want to see Raqqa done before I go home.
Iraqi forces last month declared eastern Mosul fully liberated after launching his assault on October. Townsend said he hopes those forces will be resuming their offensive to take western Mosul in the next few days. His remarks come as the U.S. military has been directed by President Trump to develop a plan to accelerate the campaign to defeat the IS group within 90 days. Ambassador James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Townsend's timeline is possible, but it depends on what the Trump administration's strategy turns out to be.
Depending on what is in that plan and what the president's willing to approve, I think that is relevant to any determination of 6 months. Certainly it's possible. The fighting has gone better in Mosul since January. ISIS in Syria is fighting on four fronts. Iraq are against the U.S. and a largely Kurdish task force, then in al-Bab against the Turks and the Free Syrian Army, plus some Assad government, and then on two other fronts against the Assad government. So they're being stretched thin. So I think it's quite possible that in 6 months we'll see ISIS wiped out, but we still need to see what the plan is from the administration.
Will it require additional U.S. forces?
Almost certainly, if you want to do it rapidly. And the other thing is, what do you want the day after? This will leave a huge gaping hole in western Iraq and eastern Syria in the middle of great turmoil in the Middle East that goes beyond ISIS, specifically Iran, Syria, Russia's role, other extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda that might take advantage of this. What's our role going to be after then in the region? And that has an impact on whether you put more troops in too.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis spoke with his Iraqi counterpart by phone Wednesday for the first time, discussing, quote, planning for operations to liberate western Mosul.
That's an ongoing operation, and that's going to be somewhat independent of this study that the administration is doing. That study is going to focus mainly on Raqqa. The western Mosul, that's basically a tactical operation at this point.
Are you encouraged by the recent developments since President Trump came into office vis-a-vis Iraq?
None of these developments are based on Trump. And the most encouraging thing about Iraq since he got in was that the Iraq portion of the immigration ban was extremely dangerous and extremely unfortunate. But because we've got a stay of it, for the moment, Iraqis are still able to travel. That was a huge mistake.
What is the problem with that portion of the travel restriction?
First of all, who were the other states targeted? Iran and five failed states. Iraq is neither a failed state nor is it an enemy state. It does have a significant al-Qaeda component. And as you know, and as most people know by now, the list was drawn up by the Obama administration, but for a different purpose. It was to limit visa-free travel to the U.S. of people who are subject to visa-free travel who had visited those seven countries. That's a different category than everybody from those countries because Iraq is full of our allies.
Former U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute of Near East Policy, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Human rights activists have launched a court action to try to stop the British government from selling arms to Saudi Arabia. Critics accuse the Saudi-led coalition, which is supported by the United States and Britain, of violating international law through its bombing of civilian areas as it battles Houthi rebels in Yemen. Henry Ridgewell reporting now from the High Court in London.
In October 2016, Zuhair and his family were attending the funeral of a sheikh in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. More than 1,000 people were packed in the community hall when warplanes fired two missiles at the building. More than 140 people were killed and 500 injured.
My uncle then carried me away. I was burnt. My face, hands and my feet were very burnt. Then we took a taxi home. My clothes were burnt. All of me was burnt.
Zuhair's family was unable to pay for treatment and he did not receive any medical attention for 2 weeks. The group Human Rights Watch says forensic evidence from the bomb site shows the missiles came from Saudi jets, though Riyadh has denied responsibility. The Saudi-led military intervention, supported by the United States and Britain, is aimed at countering Iranian-backed Houthi fighters who control the capital, Sana'a. But critics say one in three airstrikes have hit civilian sites, killing thousands of people. The London-based campaign against the arms trade says Britain has sold Saudi Arabia weapons worth $4.1 billion since the Yemen conflict began in March 2015. This week, the group brought a legal case against the British government.
We've seen the UN panel of experts come out and say that it looks like there's widespread and systematic targeting of civilians by the Royal Saudi Air Force in the attacks on Yemen. Now, if UK export control legislation means anything, then the UK government must call an immediate halt to arms sales to Saudi.
Britain says it operates a robust export control system and keeps arms sales to Saudi Arabia under continuous review. But aid groups say the conflict has caused one of the world's worst humanitarian catastrophes.
There are 10 million children in need of humanitarian assistance, and 500,000 children have severe acute malnutrition. So there have obviously been breaches of international law on all sides, but Saudi Arabia is a key ally of Britain. Britain is selling arms to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi-led coalition is killing children in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia denies deliberately targeting civilians. The British High Court is expected to make its ruling in the next few weeks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Some children from the Democratic Republic of Congo who have been adopted by Italian families may have been taken from their biological families in exchange for money. The children were part of a group who arrived in Italy as orphaned migrant children. That announcement coming from Silvia Della Monica, who is vice president of the Italian government's Commission on International Adoptions. From Milan, reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story, provides us with details now as she speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis. By the way, I apologize for the static phone connection.
We're hearing that three children who were adopted by Italian families from the Democratic Republic of Congo may have been taken or allegedly were taken from their families for money, and that is under investigation. Silvia Della Monica, the vice president of the government body responsible for international adoption, says it is being investigated, so judicial authorities have been notified and further investigation is taking place. But if this is true, it's certainly very alarming.
Do you have any information on what either families are saying, the families from the children, also the adopted families?
We haven't had any information or any feedback from the families concerned. But these children are believed to be among a group of 18. They were the last group out of a total of 66 children that were approved for adoption by the DRC last June. They were the last group to have received approval. This has been a very complicated issue between Italy and the DRC over the last couple of years. For a very long time, dozens of adoptions were blocked by the Democratic Republic of Congo. After intense negotiation between the two countries, the adoptions finally went through. It's a very complicated issue, and now there will obviously be further investigation to find out what's really happened regarding these three children.
Do you have the status on the rest of the children? There were a total of 66 children, I understand.
It was certainly a very joyful occasion for the Italian families who have waited several years for the final approval of these adoptions. So when they finally came through, it was a big deal in Italy. And the Italian foreign minister at the time, Paolo Gentiloni, who's now the prime minister, even expressed his satisfaction and thanked the authorities for making this possible. But since the children actually arrived in Italy, we've heard very little from the families as they have been trying to settle the children into Italian society and make a transition. But certainly, this issue has had a lot of attention in Italy over the last few years. The Italians were negotiating for some time in a very lengthy process to adopt these individual children, to take them into their families. I imagine there was extensive research done before they could be released from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So you would assume that all the checks had been conducted, that they were indeed orphans looking to be adopted by Italian families. And so if these children are found to have been adopted by Italian families for money, taken from their own families for money, this is certainly going to set a precedent and probably result further investigation of the other cases as well.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna in Milan. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have long thought that there are two types of black holes. Smaller-sized black holes called stellar black holes and gigantic, supermassive black holes. Astronomers at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics say they have found new evidence of a medium-sized or intermediate-mass black hole with a mass of about 2,200 suns hiding in the center of a globular star cluster some 13,000 light-years from Earth. While a few intermediate-mass black holes had been spotted in the past, Bulent Kisseldon, a Harvard astrophysicist, says that all past claims of finding an intermediate black hole have been inconclusive and were subject to opposition by scientists who found these findings to be equally consistent with other phenomena. Kisseldon says that scientists want to find intermediate mass black holes because they are the missing link between stellar mass and supermassive black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, the Grammy Awards are on Sunday, and what people are wearing could generate as much buzz as who wins the coveted awards. VOA's David Byrd reports that the Grammys can be more cutting-edge than other award shows, but the trend has been toward the haute couture style.
The Grammy Awards are mostly about music, but they are as much about the fashions the artists wear as the music they make. The Grammy red carpet can offer designers an audience that they won't get from other award shows, so the top houses and designers are eager to dress the stars. George Katsiopoulos co-hosted the Fashion Police show for years with the late Joan Rivers. He says that music stars have more freedom to express their style at the Grammys than at other awards shows.
I mean, there might be a black tie attire required, but no one goes by it. No one cares. The guys can wear T-shirts and ripped jeans. The girls can wear that. Now, mostly it's outrageous. The women can be scantily clad and super sexy, but in recent years, a lot of women, including like Rihanna, every Rihanna look is fabulous. They've been wearing like haute couture. They've been wearing designers. They've been wearing gowns. I mean, Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, which is unusual. They're treating it almost as if it is the Oscars, but it's you know, can be a little bit more out there.
Katsiopoulos says his all-time favorite Grammy look was pop diva Jennifer Lopez's plunging Versace dress at the 2000 Grammy Awards.
The absolute most iconic Grammy look ever is J-Lo in that Versace look with the palm trees and plunging down to here. I mean, I think that is just like, you can look in the dictionary and it would say Grammy red carpet and there would be a photo of that. You know, if that defines the Grammy red carpet, I think.
George Katsiopoulos says that in recent years, stars like Beyoncé, Rihanna, Taylor Swift, and Katy Perry have tended to wear more haute couture styles. Not as flashy, but still high fashion.
So as far as like the Grammys go, they have these really great dresses. Like this is from this French designer, Alexis Mabi. So I was saying ladies are wearing more couture looks. This isn't something you'd wear to the Oscars, but for the Grammys it works. Is it's got this like kind of weird detail that's super cool with these sleeves, and it's just a beautiful color. Yeah, this is something that like Rihanna would wear.
Katsiopoulos predicts that some stars might try something a little more daring this year, like sequined pajamas. One thing he says fans can look for is more fun styles, not something as conservative or traditional as they see at this month's Oscars. The Grammy Awards are Sunday night at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Sequin pajamas? Oh, okay. I'll have to tune in. A near-fatal stroke could not take away that signature baritone voice of country music star Randy Travis, and dozens of his friends from Garth Brooks to Kenny Rogers used their voices and his songs to honor the legend this week. Travis watched from the side of the stage in Nashville, Tennessee, as country stars from multiple eras, that is, sang many of his songs. Performers included Wynonna, Alabama, Chris Young, Travis Tritt, and Jeff Boxworthy. Randy's wife, Mary, was by his side on stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, heroes and friends, tonight I want to give back to you the voice of Randy Travis. If you would all join in with Randy singing Amazing Grace.
Okay.
Garth will help you.
And Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
Randy sang that song, Amazing Grace, at the funeral in 2013 for another country music icon, George Jones.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my
Amazing voice, absolutely. Travis, whose multi-platinum debut album, Storms of Life, in 1986, made him a big star, suffered a stroke in 2013, not long after attending the funeral for George Jones. That initially took away his ability to speak or even read, for that matter, but he has been steadily recovering through voice rehabilitation. Good luck to Randy Travis. Still sounding relatively good out there on the stage. Listen, everyone, thanks very much for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Up next, the latest world news, so we hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Nelson Lopes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has once again condemned Russia's action in Ukraine following an escalation in fighting between government forces and Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Speaking publicly for the first time before the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Permanent Representative to the U.N., Ambassador Nikki Haley, deplored the fact that the United States must repeatedly condemn the aggressive actions of Russia.
It is unfortunate because it is a replay of far too many instances over many years in which United States representatives have needed to do that. It should not have to be that way. We do want to better our relations with Russia. However, the dire situation in eastern Ukraine is one that demands clear and strong condemnation of Russian actions.
Eastern Ukraine is not the only part of the country suffering from Russia's aggressive actions. Ambassador Haley pointed to Russia's occupation of Crimea and called for its immediate end.
Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine. The basic principle of this United Nations is that states should live side by side in peace.
Full and immediate implementation of the Minsk agreements, which the United States continues to support, she said, is a clear path to restoring peace in Ukraine.
The Minsk agreements require the disengagement of forces and withdrawal of heavy weapons from both sides of the contact line. This is the formula for a sustainable ceasefire. Pulling back forces and taking heavy weapons out of this area will save lives. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Special Monitoring Mission must also be granted full, unfettered access.
Ambassador Haley noted that both Russia and Ukraine supported the Security Council's unanimous call on January 31st to return to a ceasefire. It is the first time in years that this council was able to come together on Ukraine, she said. The United States expects that those who can influence the groups that are fighting, in particular Russia, will do everything possible to support an end to this escalation of violence. The United States stands with the people of Ukraine who have suffered for nearly 3 years under Russian occupation and military intervention, said Ambassador Haley. Until Russia and the separatists it supports respect Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, this crisis will continue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours.